This is Lecture 8 in the course on Critical Theory, Cultural Studies, and Postmodern Theory. We're well into the postmodern theorists, and today we're going to look at postmodern theory's particular prong of post-structuralism. One way to understand post-structuralism is to consider it as against structuralism, which precedes it. We'll describe what structuralism is. But let's say post-structuralism denies the universals or ahistorical features, those features that persist supposedly across time and across cultures in structuralism. The denial of universals might be considered, for example, as against Kant, although Kant wasn't a structuralist as such. He nevertheless can be used as an example for how post-structuralism differs from structuralism. Kant posited a priori intuitions that inform our experience, such as time and space in particular. These were interior to the subject, and they informed the subject's experience. Time does not exist except in the subject, and the same goes for space. They are receptacles in the subject. They're a priori receptacles, if you will, that inform our experience and allow us to experience in terms of time and space. Kant also posited a priori categories that informed our understanding. Now, with post-structuralism, under structuralism, I mean such forms and categories were seen as universal and ahistorical. They're true for all places and all times. Post-structuralism, on the other hand, historicizes such forms and concepts. They are seen as historically contingent and culturally contingent. They are different in terms of time and place, culture, etc. So Saussure, for example, was a structuralist linguist, and he posited his linguistic model as applying universally. His model of the sign, for example, the sign broken up into the signifier and the signified, he saw these as structures that pertained everywhere, at all times and places where language is used. Post-structuralists like Derrida, as we will see, saw Saussure as applying specifically to the West, Saussure's structures as applying specifically to the West, that he was deriving his model from Western linguistics. We could see the structuralism of Freud and Lacan, for example. The notion that there are these distinct categories, like in Freud, you have the drama of the child, which involves the penis and penis envy in the case of the female child, the drama of the Oedipal complex, and so on and so forth. Post-structuralists saw these structures as historically and culturally contingent, as we shall see in Foucault. One other way to understand post-structuralism is as opposed to humanism. Humanism posits this subject with individual volition, will, cognition, rationality, reason, etc., etc. Post-structuralism will, quote-unquote, decenter this subject. That is, it's no longer the center of inquiry, and it's no longer the center of action. Rather, the subject is not a pre-existing category for post-structuralism. The subject is not universally the same, moreover. And the subject is produced by discourse or other means, as we shall see in Foucault. And that brings us to Michel Foucault, who lived from 1926 to 1984. Of course, he's a French writer, an historian, philosopher, social theorist, and literary critic. He is, by the way, the most widely cited scholar in the humanities and social sciences, if not in the academy at large. Some of his central ideas, the most important of which is this notion of power and knowledge, the power and knowledge nexus, as it's often referred to. And this idea is not the same as Bacon's idea that knowledge is power, but rather that knowledge depends on the requisite power to produce and to make it count as knowledge as such. So power is productive of knowledge. It requires power to assert and have something count as knowledge. So power and knowledge are intricately connected, and they are utterly contingent upon each other. Knowledge is carried, moreover, through discourses used for social control. So power and knowledge travel together through discourses, which are means of controlling populations, according to Foucault. Now, this differs from structuralism in the sense that for post-structuralists like Foucault, there are many different discourses. They're incommensurate with each other. There's not a master discourse. There are many different power sites and centers. It's not just the state or capitalism or anything like that. It's power is carried in these various institutions which have different discourses to order the experience and the subjects in those areas. And discourses are productive of and carriers of power. This is how power is maintained, is through discourses. Discourses that structure the environment and the structure of the subjects within it, hierarchies, etc., etc. So power and knowledge come together and they travel in discourses. For example, in his book, The History of Sexuality, The Will to Knowledge, Volume 1, 1976, obviously a play on Nietzsche's notebooks, The Will to Power, Foucault argues that Victorian sexuality was actually a production of the discourses surrounding sex, which also produced sexuality as such. That is, the very idea of sexuality is a product of discourse. We shall see what he means here. He argues that the Freudian notion of sexual repression, which was such a standard for understanding the Victorian period late in the 19th century and early 20th century, was actually a discourse which produced what Freud took to be a universal. He argues that the Freudian notion of sexual repression actually produced sexuality. The Freudian notion that sexual repression is one of the bases for civilization, he sees as actually productive of sexuality. What does he mean by that? He argues that Freud's repressive hypothesis, this idea of sexual repression as the one of the keys to the semblance of civilization, demonstrated a Victorian titillation regarding sex, which in itself generated pleasure and produced sexuality. The discourse surrounding sex, new in the 19th century, produced sexuality because it was not so much repressive as productive. And this is one of the keys about Foucault's notion of power and discourse. Discourses are not merely repressive, they are productive of their subjects. And in this case, they're productive of sexuality as such. Now, what does he mean here? Of course, there were always discrete sex acts throughout human history. But according to Foucault, the idea of sexuality was born sometime in the 17th century. That is, a set of packages that connected to sexual behavior, such that you had heterosexuality and eventually homosexuality. These were all produced, and they were productions of discourse, according to Foucault. Now, Foucault also studied the history of detention and punishment. In particular, in his very well-read and probably most cited book, Discipline and Punish, from 1975, he discussed the mutation of power across time and according to various principles. Here we are. He argues that power mutated from the pre-modern to the modern period, and that punishment has since become discipline, which has permeated the entire social body. this change of power, its mutation from the pre-modern to the modern period, included a shift away from the primarily corporal forms of punishment we see in the Middle Ages, for example, of torturing, quartering, branding, and other brutal rituals for inflicting bodily pain. But also, it included power decentralization from the king, for example, or the state. Its metastasis and permeation of the entire social body, such that we live in a disciplinary society, according to Foucault. Its effects are no longer confined to the imprisoned, the insane, or otherwise detained, but apply universally. This new disciplinary regime included the reformed prisons and other places of confinement, but also escaped the confines of institutions to become applied universally to the entire population. The whole society became a disciplinary society. And he gives us a model for this disciplinary society. He shows how these technologies of discipline practiced with the rise of what he calls panopticism have become less forceful, more lightweight, less burdensome to the body, but at the same time utterly ubiquitous. And he gets this notion of panopticism from Jeremy Bentham's model of the panopticon to illustrate this mutation of punishment into discipline. This is the panopticon. It consists of a central tower with cells surrounding it. And the idea here is that at any time there could be a guard in the tower. The inmates surrounded in cells. Now, the person in the tower can see into the cells, but the persons in the cells cannot see into the tower. This leads to the sense that one might be observed at all times. And according to Foucault, this caused the interiorization, the internalization of the idea of being surveilled upon, so that one becomes one's own surveiller. One becomes the principle of one's own subjection, as he put it later in this book. So the idea is that this model is basically the model of discipline that pertains to the entire society. Everyone is under this kind of disciplinary surveillance at all times. Whether one is being seen, one could always be seen. One doesn't know whether one is being watched or not. So therefore, one internalizes this surveillance and becomes one's own surveiller. Foucault's work on the prison system led to his activism for prison reform, and this is very typical of the kind of political work he did, is he tried to do what he called these local politics. And by local, he doesn't mean in your town or community. He means at various sites, institutional sites, like the prison, the asylum, and so forth. He worked on prison reform, reform of insane asylums, and so on and so forth. Foucault conceives of power as this ubiquitous, nebulous, decentralized, and localized force. It is not strictly located in the state at all. Power is everywhere, in particular institutions, and every institution has its own power structure with its own discourses to produce power and carry it. Unlike Nietzsche, who granted centrality to power, Foucault's treatment of power is utterly oppositional. Power is to be opposed wherever it manifests itself. I've mentioned that Foucault effectively stood Nietzsche on his head, and this is what I mean. While he takes power to be the central modus operandus of human life, he sees it as something that is centralized in various, not centralized, but located in various institutions that needs to be opposed by the subject wherever it manifests itself. So instead of embracing power, he's opposing it. Unlike Nietzsche, who relished power and thought it should be something embraced. This brings us to the notion of the subject according to post-structuralism. That is the human subject. And in order to treat this idea of the human subject under post-structuralism, I'm going to do a short exegesis of two essays, one by Michel Foucault and another by a precursor, but also considered by others to be a post-structuralist himself, Roland Barthes. These two essays are The Death of the Author by Roland Barthes in 1967, and What is an Author by Foucault in 1969. They're just nice, short essays that allow us to get a handle on the post-structuralist notion of the subject, which comes vis-a-vis a discussion of the author. The author becomes a prototype of the subject, if you will, a particular valorized subject type. From there, we get into the notion of the post-structuralist idea of the subject itself. We begin with Barthes. In The Death of the Author, Barthes wrote that rather than writing himself into immortality, the author actually dies at the moment of writing. Now, what on earth could he possibly mean by this? The author's death comes at the very moment of writing. He says, literature is that neuter, that composite, that oblique, no noun there, into which every subject escapes, that trap where all identity is lost, beginning with the very identity of the body that writes. Now, what is he getting at here? How could he possibly be saying this? Probably, he says, this has always been the case. Once an action is recounted, that is narrated, for intransitive ends, that is, rather than describing something or commanding something in the moment, and no longer in order to act directly upon reality, but to rather narrate something that's already happened, that is finally external to any function but the very exercise of the symbol itself of language, this disjunction occurs. This disjunction between the writer and the self of the body. This disjunction, the voice loses its origin. The author enters his own death. Writing begins. The emphasis is mine here, and I emphasize intransitive. Transitive verbs, of course, are action verbs, so intransitive means there's no action being dictated in the moment, like, go get that cup of water. It's rather, so-and-so brought a cup of water over, and I drank it then, and so on and so forth. One way to understand this idea of the death of the author is that writing was always meant for communication in the absence of the writer. So absence here could be equated with death somehow. For example, when we write a letter or an email, we do so because we cannot be present to speak to the person. Well, we might be, but in many cases we just don't want to talk to them. That's how things go now. But narration has been conceived of differently in different cultures. That is, it hasn't always been considered in terms of death. In primitive societies, the narrator is a medium or a shaman or a speaker who speaks on behalf of or as an intermediary for some spirit or force. One would never speak, however, of the genius of the shaman. They might say he performs his task eloquently or whatever, but it's not deemed to be something intrinsic to the person. His talent is not, the writing is not his production. And likewise, the author, the idea of an author as an original source is a modern invention. Quote, the author is a modern figure, produced no doubt by our society insofar as, at the end of the Middle Ages, with English empiricism, French rationalism, and the personal faith of the Reformation, it discovered the prestige of the individual, or to put it more nobly, of the human person. So what are we getting at here? With the Reformation, you have the reading of the Bible individually, and then there's an argument that the individual self or individuality only becomes possible after this Reformation. The idea of individual selfhood as a and the individual as a standalone subject to be revered as the noble person comes with the Reformation. And he also adds English empiricism, or that is the location of scientific, or I should say that scientific reductionism, reducing everything to its smallest parts, and French rationalism also the same. Rationality actually breaks down to the root of ratio, one-to-one being the ratio at hand here. Authors have been generally regarded as the sources of original works. That is, we think of authors as producing these original works that come out of themselves, that they then spill onto the page in the moment of inspiration or genius and so on and so forth. But as Barth suggests, we know that a text does not consist of a line of words releasing a single theological meaning, the message of the author God, but is a space of many dimensions in which are wedded and contested various kinds of writing, no one of which is original. The text is a tissue of citations resulting from the thousand sources of culture. So, all writing is merely montage or collage or reportage. That is to say, there's nothing coming originally. We're merely pasting and putting together various cultural references and memories and previous writing. Every piece of writing is just some sort of amalgamation of previous writing. This starts to get, we start to get a hint of what's happening to the subject here. Meanwhile, the author is a product of the text and not the other way around. So it's not that the author produces the text, but the author is a post facto construction of a text after the fact. And you can see this somehow. You're not a poet until you've written a book of poetry. So therefore, in a sense, the poetry produces the poet. Or a novel. You're not a novelist until you've written a novel. So in a sense, the novel produces the novelist. Well, we can see it's sort of a chicken and egg situation here, but he says the author is supposed to feed the book, that he supposedly feeds the book, that is, he pre-existed, thinks, suffers, lives for it. He maintains with his work the same relation of antecedents as a father maintains with his child. And I emphasize supposedly because he's suggesting that it's not the case that he feeds the book or that he pre-exists it. So it isn't just that the book produces the author post hoc, but rather that the author's not there feeding the book. Quite the contrary, he goes on, the modern writer or scriptor is born simultaneously with his text. He is in no way supplied with a being which precedes or transcends his writing. He is in no way the subject of which his book is the predicate. Okay, so subject and predicate, simple grammar. So-and-so does this. The this comes after the so-and-so does it. It presupposes a subject capable of undertaking something. Here he's saying that there's no precedence here of the subject. The writing subject does not precede the book. The book is not a predicate. For him, the scriptor, on the contrary, his hand, detached from any voice, borne by a pure gesture of transcription and not of expression, that is, of the self, traces a field without origin, or which at least has no other origin than language itself. That is the very thing which ceaselessly questions any origin, language. So here we see that the author is actually a product of language rather than the other way around. The author is produced by language. It follows from this that reading a text should not be a quest for origins. either in the author's biography or in the social body from which he derives some sociological understanding of a text or a biographical explanation for it, because there's no secret to be discovered, he says. Once the author is gone, which he's accomplished, he thinks, the claim to decipher a text becomes quite useless. In a multiple writing, that is this collage that we talked about, indeed, everything is to be distinguished, but nothing deciphered. There's no deep meaning. Structure can be followed, threaded like a stocking that has a run in all its recurrences and all its stages, but there's no underlying ground. The space of the writing is to be traversed, not to be penetrated. You're not looking for the depth to see where the author's soul might lie, and so on. Writing ceaselessly posits meaning, but always in order to evaporate it. It proceeds to a systematic exemption of meaning. Thus, literature, it would be better henceforth to say writing, by refusing to assign to the text and to the world as a text a secret, that is, an ultimate meaning, liberates an activity which we might call counter-theological, as against the author God, properly revolutionary, for to refuse to arrest meaning is finally to refuse God and his hypostases, that is what underlies it, reason, science, and the law. So he sees something radical here about undermining the author. This is very iconoclastic. It is a way of destroying the idols, or at least destroying God as the source, the author God in particular here. We can see now how this anything goes reading of literature or any text follows from this perspective, and anything goes reading. We can see whatever we want in a text because the author is no longer authorizing our reading. Our reading is coming from the reader. Thus, quote, he says, the true locus of writing is reading. So really where the creativity is taking place is in the reader. That is, the meanings of a text is or are given by the readers, not the author or the writer. Everybody is importing their own reading, so there's no two readings of a novel that are the same. There is no such novel as Bleak House, for example. Bleak House is a text, it's a multivocal text that can be read in many different ways, as many ways as there are readers. This emphasis on the reader would eventually give rise to what has been called reader response theory and reader response criticism. Reader response theory is that this theory of reading literature or something else in such a way that the reader's response is primary. It isn't what's supposedly intrinsic to the text that matters, it's what's intrinsic to the reader that matters, or extrinsic even to the reader, for that matter. And he says, a text consists of multiple writings, issuing from several cultures and entering into a dialogue with each other, into parody, into contestation. But there is one place where this multiplicity is collected, united, and this place is not the author, as we have hitherto said it was, but the reader. The reader is the very space in which which are inscribed without any being lost, all the citations a writing consists of. The unity of a text is not in its origin, it is in its destination. I think that's pretty clear. What he's getting at here is that it is the reader who finally makes a sensible meaning out of a collected multiplicity of writings, which are the text, and that is the reader that unites these multiplicities, not the author. Well, this kind of disclaims the possibility that the author is a reader in the first place, and that what you have is the author's reading of something, including a text or a body of text, or even the world as a text, if you will. But lest we think that the reader is the new subject here, whose history, biography, or interests count, that is, we're not locating a different subject, Bart continues, but this destination can no longer be personal. The reader is a man without history, without biography, without psychology. He is only that someone who holds gathered in a single field all the paths of which the text is constituted. He's merely a location, merely a palimpsest on which writing is done. Very much closer now we're getting to this notion of the subject under post-structuralism, which we will continue with Foucault. Thus we see the subject is beginning to be dismantled. And as I said, we'll continue this with Foucault and What is an Author, which was written 2 years later in 1969, clearly a response to Bart. He picks up many of Bart's central premises, but he goes further. After reiterating Bart's claim about the death of the author, Foucault notes that the author is nevertheless still celebrated through the work. So despite the fact that the author's dead, he gets resuscitated in this idea of the work. The focus on the work, as recommended by Bart and others, smuggles the author back into consideration. After all, why are we looking at particular texts at all? Why look, for example, at the notebooks of Nietzsche? Because Nietzsche is the author of certain other works, of course. So therefore, the author is smuggled in the back door again, just by virtue of paying attention to various works. We don't read a matchbook, the text on the back of a matchbook the way we read a treatise on philosophy, for example. So this brings in the notion of that somebody wrote this book, and that must be the author, and therefore we're celebrating the author without even admitting it. This focus on writing as such, on the other hand, also keeps the author's image alive and means that writing fails to escape his impact. Basically alluded to that already. Here's a quote. This usage of the notion of writing, which he's talking here about Bart, and the way he wrote about it, runs the risk of maintaining the author's privileges under the protection of writing's a priori status. It keeps alive in the gray light of neutralization the interplay of those representations that formed a particular image of the author. You can see these post-structuralists and postmoderns are very poetic. The author's disappearance, which, since Mallarmé, has been a constantly recurring event, is subject to a series of transcendental barriers. He never says what those barriers are, but one of them is this idea that the author's image is kept alive through this idea of the work. Likewise, it is not enough, however, to repeat the empty affirmation that the author has disappeared. And you see how these post-structuralists and postmodernists play on each other's work, but they have to go some step further to keep relevant and to say something new. Instead, Foucault means to examine the space left empty by the author's disappearance. So, the way I've talked about this in classes is imagine a body of a dead person exhumed and there's really nothing left. The body is completely deteriorated into the soil, but nevertheless there's an impression left in the ground where the body had lain. This is kind of like what he means by examining the space left empty by the author's disappearance. So what does this outline indicate? What does this impression in the ground tell us about the author? In this space, Foucault first finds the author's name. This is the most important thing. You might find it on a tombstone, for example. But the name has a certain function, and this is important for the author as such. He notes that an author's name doesn't necessarily indicate a biographical person. it indicates a body of text. And the way he gets to this is by talking about some earlier authors who weren't exactly biographical characters, like Homer, for example. Homer was originally an oral tradition, if you will, and a single person's name was affixed to a body of writing, which were probably carried on by many different persons. Nevertheless, we title them under a single name, Homer. Other examples could surely be found. It would seem that the author's name, unlike other proper names, like a biological name, and this is strange how he puts this, but this is how he does it, it does not pass from the interior of a discourse to the real and exterior individual who produced it. Instead, the name seems always to be present, marking off the edges of the text, revealing or at least characterizing its mode of being. What he's saying here is the author's name doesn't point to a biographical figure, to an exterior or real individual, instead to a body of text, which has a certain perimeter, and which has a certain status in society. It has a mode of being. The body of text, moreover, has a certain status, as I suggest. It is not regarded in the same way as the writing on a cereal box, for example. It's an elevated text. It's a text that's given some status. The author's name manifests the appearance of a certain discursive set, a body of text, and indicates the status of this discourse within a society and a culture. Okay, it's an elevated status. These texts are endowed with the author function, as he puts it, while others are deprived of it. So certain texts are deemed to have been authored, and certain texts are not. For example, you might even say a commercial on television has a writer but doesn't have an author. So the author function is something that elevates certain texts above others and determines how they are regarded, circulated, distributed, etc., etc., received, read, on and on. Foucault notes that for several centuries, authors have been celebrated as individuals of extraordinary talent, as the founts of creative beauty. So what bounty? So here's the function of the author, finally. He's going to get to the point where we're talking about what is the function of an author. And he calls it the author function. It's no longer a person. It's a textual or cultural artifact that works. It has is a kind of a function, as in math. It's something you feed things through, and it comes out with something else as a function of that function. But the author functions, or rather turning the author into a textual or cultural artifact, the author function actually serves to control and restrict discourse, determining just who is authorized to produce fiction, broadly construed. So rather than the author being this source of creative bounty, he's suggesting that the author serves as a limit to creativity, to a limit to what counts as fiction, to limit what is authorized to be said. While we think of authors as sources of new, original, and unlimited meaning, the real role of authors is to stymie the proliferation of meaning, to give it limits, to posit limits on what can be said. So the author may be dead, but the author function still functions. The function of the author is thus an ideological one. Why? Because the author's reputed function, which is creative bounty and so on and so forth, is actually the opposite of his historically real function. The author is not the source of meaning, but rather a limiter of it. Therefore, our understanding of it is ideological because we have the wrong opposite understanding. Marx understood ideology as basically standing, looking at things through a camera obscura, upside down and inside out. He's importing this very notion of ideology here to talk about what the real function of the author is. It's not the source of meaning, but a means of limiting it. Therefore, it's ideological. It is not doing what we think it is. It's doing the opposite thereof. As their supposed sources, authors often laid claim to the ownership of works. But in fact, authors do not create works. Works create their authors. The author is a function of the text, a product of language, not its source. What's more, the individual subject itself, of which the author is but a type and a highly elevated type, that is, an individual personhood, this too is a textual production. So here we get to the post-structuralist idea of the subject. It is a textual production. The person is a function of language. This takes us to the end of the discussion on Foucault and our introduction to post-structuralism. We will pick up with Derrida in the next lecture. Thank you.